Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, this is Lily Gorin with the New Books Network, the New Books in Political Science podcast. Today I'm joined by Sarah Coleman, who is the author of The Walls Within, The Politics of Immigration in Modern America. This book was published in 2021 by Princeton University Press, and it is incredibly topical in talking about how immigrants, both papered and non-papered, operate within the United States, and how the state in its many incarnations interacts with all kinds of folks in the United States, citizens and non-citizens alike. But I will let Sarah talk a lot about that. I'd like to welcome Sarah Coleman to the New Books in Political Science podcast and ask her to tell us a little bit about herself and how she came to this project. Hi, Sarah.
Hi. Thank you so much, Lily, for having me. I really appreciate it. And I'm so excited to speak with sort of this diverse audience of listeners about this book and sort of this project writ large. I came to this project sort of in a couple different ways. One is I've always been interested in immigration history and immigration stories. I've also fundamentally been interested in sort of definitions of citizenship, right? And what does it mean? What are rights and benefits and entitlements sort of, and how has notions of what that means to individuals changed over time? And then third, I've always been sort of interested really in this sort of political contestation around federalism in the United States. And so those three sort of main nodes of inquiry sort of came together in this project. I'm originally from Brooklyn, New York, and I grew up there. And I worked in politics for about 5 years before going to graduate school. I worked in the U.S. Senate and then in the Obama administration in the White House, working on domestic policy issues for then Vice President Joseph Biden. And so a lot of that sort of interest in how the inner workings and sort of part of my book about the inner workings of politics, right, is informed by that experience working on the Hill and in the White House and sort of interested in sort of how the sausage gets made in terms of policy. And sort of that sort of background, personal background, sort of influences how I write and sort of how I research projects. And then I went off to, after the White House, I went off to graduate school and sort of really got to dig in deeper to these questions that I'd seen playing out in DC, right? And sort of wanted to sort of really understand some of these questions and sort of answer, how did we get here, right? And what does that mean going forward? And that's kind of the real impetus behind the book. And then as I've been writing this book, I've been here at Texas State University, and obviously immigration is first and foremost present in everyday lives everywhere in America, but particularly here in Texas. And so I think it sort of was really interesting to sort of move here and be revising and sort of editing this book in a place to see how this is playing out in particular in a certain community here in Central Texas.
And you certainly do, you know, answer the question in a certain sense of how did we get here with regard to domestic politics around immigration and to some degree have signaling about what may or may not happen next. And this is a complicated story, right? Immigration in the United States has never been necessarily a, quote, simple story, particularly when there have been moves and policies to try to manage, so-called manage that. So if you could start off a little bit by explaining the brief history to some degree how we got where we are now, which, you know, sort of stops a little bit in 1965 and moves on to something else a little bit different. But you certainly do have this broad sweep of sort of immigration history in the United States from the earliest days of the pre-republic to sort of more contemporary periods.
Yeah. And I think in particular, what the focus that I really take to the project and sort of where, and I think a lot of our current day-to-day news headlines and a lot of the current literature right out there about immigration policy writ large sort of really focuses on the Southwest border or particular border regions. And I think what lens I wanted to bring to this history that I try to draw both from deep historical all the way through the present, and what we know about immigration policy today is it isn't just about admissions and deportations, which are important, right? And that it's just one piece, and a lot of the current dialogue, right, is just one piece of a puzzle from where much of the real anti-immigrant effort lies today and has been in the past, which is in businesses and schools and communities sort of inside of our borders. And I wanted to sort of look at how immigrants in the United States today have dramatically worse access to the rights and social safety net than they did just 50 years ago. And how has that sort of changed over time from the beginning of the sort of republic through, but really focusing on sort of where we 1965 forward. And I wanted to write the story of how that happened, and particularly what it means for all of us living permanently in the United States, right? Not just those who are unauthorized, right? Or authorized, you know. And so I guess I'll sort of talk about how I do that. So I begin my book in the wake of the Hart-Celler Act of 1965, right, which was a key piece of legislation, right, in Lyndon Johnson's Great Society, right? It's passed sort of in the year following the Civil Rights Act in this moment, right, of sort of this idea of equality. And it ends the national quota system of the 1920s, and it launches this new era in admissions policy, and actually in immigration more broadly. So not only do I argue, right, that it reshape admissions policy, it starts to set into place a massive demographic change, right, that's going to reshape American society and culture. And it launches, I argue, these deep debates over the place of the immigrant in American life. And as what we see post-1965 is that as controlling admissions to the United States across the southern border becomes more difficult for policymakers, the battle to control immigrants in large part shifted from external borders to these internal ones. And I sort of was like, how do I really focus? You could put a wide plethora of topics on like where sort of are these internal borders. And I decided for the framing of my book to sort of look in four key areas where I felt the state touched an individual's life. And so there's education, labor, welfare rights, and civil liberties. And so the book is sort of structured in that way. I begin in the 1970s with the fight over educational rights for unauthorized immigrant children in a case called Plyler v. Doe, which starts in 1977 and actually doesn't come to the Supreme Court until the early 1980s. But in Tyler, which is for those of you who may not be familiar with the geography of Texas, it's a small town on the eastern part of the state. The local school board announced in 1977 that they were going to begin charging tuition for unauthorized students of $1,000, which is basically cost prohibitive in today's dollars. It's about $3,000 to $4,000. And I trace the story of how these local families connected with this sort of national civil rights organizations and took this case all the way to the Supreme Court. And as much as it's sort of looking at how this immigrants' rights question connects with sort of the larger rights revolution, right? How are the networks that these families are tying into, right, are legacies of the African-American civil rights movement? How do they draw on sort of the legal arguments of the civil rights movement to bring this case to the Supreme Court? And on the other side, I look at how sort of conservative groups like the Mountain States Legal Foundation, who are responding to the rights revolution of the 60s, right, sort of back into this case, right? And they see this case as sort of an area of their concern. And I try and sort of trace this case all the way to the Supreme Court. And groups like the Mountain States Legal Foundation really are interesting because they frame, and this sort of gives an idea when I start to talk about the changes in the anti-immigrant movement in the United States, right? They frame it in sort of, this is a gross expansion of the rights revolution of the 1960s. And they talk about how it's creating a higher tax burden to pay for the government expansion. And very formally, they talk about it's a trampling of the rights of state and local institutions, right? They start to bring on this language of immigration federalism from a very early stage. And I sort of trace how in the wake of the civil rights movement, both sides sort of dig in on this case. And I look at how both the Carter and the Reagan administrations struggle to deal with it because of the politics of the moment. And I trace it through the case all the way through the Supreme Court, which backs the students in the case, right? And it's the reason why K through 12 education today in the United States, right, is entitled, students are entitled to K through 12 education regardless of their immigration status. And then I sort of move on from this sort of what we could view as a potential high watermark, right, of immigrants' rights. And I think a lot of the activists in the early 1980s sort of viewed Plyler as this like potential new opening moment. And I sort of trace sort of following that, the ways in which the anti-immigrant movement sort of digs in. And I sort of, as I mentioned, four areas. So the first one's education, then I turn to labor rights. And I look at the growing power of the anti-immigrant movement in the 1980s in battles over employer sanctions and labor rights, and show how even though the anti-immigrant movement was growing, it really is stunted by some internal divisions, both within the Republican Party and the Democratic Party. And then I move out of the 1980s to the 1990s, and I talk about welfare rights. And the 1990s, I argue overall, and I think it's important to see it as the 1990s were a pivotal decade in immigration policy. And with national politics gridlocked, as we see in the chapters on the 80s, anti-immigrant groups really turn to the state houses. And I look at welfare rights and Proposition 187 that came out of California. And Proposition 187, for those of you who did not live through it, was a 1994 ballot initiative to establish a state-run citizenship screening program, right, and prohibit unauthorized immigrants from using many state services, including non-emergency healthcare, public education, lots of state services. And one of the things that I show is that while the federal government, or sorry, the federal courts are going to invalidate Proposition 187's provisions, because the governor is going to challenge the case, the political success of the measure ends up having these huge national policy implications, right? So it also, to me, is something interesting about policy formation, right? And the way that politics, right, even can sort of drive policy formation. And conservatives like Newt Gingrich and others, right, use Proposition 187 as a model for proposals. And we see Proposition 187 plays like the electoral success of 187, even though it's invalidated, really plays a key sort of part in the development of welfare reform and the removal and limitation of access for authorized and unauthorized immigrants to key social safety net programs.
And I wanted to ask you about sort of one of the ways that you're sort of discussing all of this. Is you say Prop 187 was in California, and the case with regard to the schools was in Texas, and yet immigration, according to Article 1 of the Constitution, is this responsibility of the United States Congress, and you use the terminology immigration federalism, which is a big framing of a lot of what you are talking about in terms of the policies that are developed across the United States, more or less 1965 on. Can you explain a little bit more detail what this concept immigration federalism is, and to some degree, how it operates in the constitutional system?
Right. So immigration federalism more broadly sort of is about the role of states in performing immigration functions, right? Whether that be enforcement and I think broadly, enforcement broad. Right? If you could see me, you would know I'm like using air quotes, but enforcement, meaning sort of whatever sort of role that they're playing in immigration control and immigration policy making. And there's a bunch of scholars in political science, right, who are working in this area. Karthik Ramakrishnan, obviously, Alan Coburn, Tom Wong, all come to sort of mind at the front of my end. Legal scholars like Christina Rodriguez, right, thinking about the ways in which the increasing role that states are playing. And historically, right, we know through some amazing work that historically, up until the 1880s, much of the role of immigration control was played by states. Right. From the early, there's a great book called Expelling the Poor, right, talking about the early colonial period all the way through the 1880s. And during the 1880s, and I go through this a little bit in my book, the federal government, for both foreign policy and other concerns, through a series of cases relating to Chinese exclusion on the West Coast, begins to say to states that you have no right to perform immigration control functions. From beginning in the 1880s, it really the purview of immigration control, immigration control is in the purview of the federal government. On the ground, that's always been a little bit more murky, right, between the 1880s and present day. But really, like, on the books, right, and legally, it's been much more, through a series of court decisions, right, it's been much more thought of as a matter for the federal government. And I think what I'm arguing in the 1990s that starts to happen is you start to see that states begin to really sort of shift that dynamic and take power back into the states. And they do that in two ways. They either pressure federal authorities to delegate authority back to the states, as they do in a case I show in Iowa, or as I show in California, they pressure the federal officials to conform federal immigration policy to their preferences, right? So it's one of two ways, but either way, the sort of driver of the policy is the state versus the federal government in a new way in the 1990s.
And so the states driving the policy, as you already mentioned, that, you know, there are these high profile examples like Prop 187. And I lived through that. I remember that. That was a contentious debate and fight and drew national attention in lots and lots of ways. But as you note, there are also these smaller legal undertakings like the case in Iowa, like other cases that you pay attention to, that are also sort of pushing on this question of the states being the executors, as it were, of the national policy. And this is because in so many ways, the states are the ones who execute the policy around schools or around welfare. And so can you talk a little bit about that tangling that we've seen in part because of the rise of the welfare state in general that makes it more complex, and the entities delivering that complexity are generally the states and localities?
Yeah. And states, and I think it's a twofold thing. It has to do with the rise of the welfare state. It also has to do with movement within the United States and demographic changes, right? So I think, right, a lot of the things that were, the programs that we're talking about really come to start to really expand in the 1970s, right? So this may not have been on someone who was concerned about sort of an anti-immigrant activist sort of radar, that this was even something that people were accessing, right, until the 1970s. And we see an explosion in the 70s, 80s, early 90s of some of these social safety net programs, right? And so that brings things to the radar, to the front forefront, right, combined with sort of political, not to throw reporters under the bus, but some of the reporting and some of the narrative, right, of this, like, you know, Leo Chavez's, like, Latino threat narrative that comes up at this moment, right? Those sort of, that strand, both the rise in entitlement spending, the rise of, like, this narrative about the demographic changes, right, sort of come together at this moment to sort of, plus there's a massive demographic shift that's going on. And one of the things that I think is often not talked about and sort of I think about in terms of my own work is, you know, post-1986 and what's known as the quote-unquote Reagan amnesty, right? There's freedom of movement in the United States for many of the 3 million people who gain authorization status, right? And so you see, because of that policy change, plus some of the demographics changes, plus the changing in right to work states and all that, you see immigrant populations showing up in places that they haven't been before, right? So it really brings that conversation into new communities at the same time. And to them, that's sometimes where you start to see this access to the social safety net in the state sort of come into play, right? For example, I talk about Iowa and the rise of this program called 287G, which is a program that delegates immigration enforcement authority to state and local law enforcement. You know, Iowa didn't have a massive Latino population prior to this period, but we see changes in how meatpacking occurs, right? And demographic changes start to follow in Iowa, and the politics start to change in Iowa, right? And all of these things, and entitlement spending, and there's a, you know, downturn, farms are being hit hard, right? And that starts to change the conversation, and Iowa starts to play a role in this immigration question in a way that it never played, you know, in previous decades.
And so that, I mean, again, I live and teach in Wisconsin, and I can talk about Waukesha and Waukesha County, and the sort of tensions that exist there around the Hispanic and Latinx population that has been there for a long time, but is generally not necessarily always reflective of what folks think about when they think about Waukesha and Waukesha County, not to denigrate Waukesha or Waukesha County. But I did find the sort of complexity of the demographic question one that is really fascinating, because in today's flashpoints about immigration, right, we're always hearing about the so-called wall and building the wall on the southern border. But that the demographic shift that happened earlier on is one that is a real big part of the story that's often missed. Can you explain a little bit in a little bit more detail about that sort of demographic shift, and how and why that has had such an impact on the immigration debate?
Right. So much of our immigration policy between 1924 and 1965 was highly restrictive. You know, I think there's someone who said, think of ways in which we used, quote, immigration as a tool of mass racial engineering, right? And through the 1920s and the 1960s. And when that changes in 1965 and we get sort of this new immigration framework, right? For the first time, we have a cap on the Western Hemisphere, right? And so traditional migration patterns that have been going on for generations are now, quote, like sort of suddenly categorized differently, right? And sort of we start to there sort of becomes a narrative about sort of what's considered authorized immigration and what's not in a way that had never been there before, right? Even though these populations had sort of been moving through that period. Is that sort of answer like the historical change?
Yeah. And to some degree, you know, when what you talk about in the book is the fact that the Western Hemisphere cap is one that actually is working in opposition in a certain sense to what was expected to come out of the 1965 Act. And so while there was an equalizing, it actually was sort of a more of a suppression of the demographics that were coming from south of the US border.
Yes. And so what we start to see is a lot of populations that had previously sort of been in the United States and moving back and forth in a more cyclical fashion, right, are now considered undocumented in a new way. Right. And particularly this happens sort of beginning in you start to see this recategorization really in the mid 1970s. And then even one of the other things you see is in 86, as and particularly nowadays when you think about that, as we militarized the, in the 80s through the 90s, as we militarized the border more, what it means is that actually it's not that people stop entering the United States, they just stop sort of this, these cyclical patterns, and they end up staying more in the United States than they previously sort of would have free flowed more across across the border.
And this is certainly something, go ahead.
Remember demographically, I was going to say, to just think about the demographics, right? We have 24 million people in the United States today who do not have citizenship status, about half of whom, right, about 12 million of whom are unauthorized, right? We have a lot of conversations about the Southwest border, but there's already 24 million people here in the United States, right, who are living this in a very different reality. And it's not a question about the border, right? And it's a question who are living and building communities here in the United States. And I think sort of taking, shifting our focus away from the border and sort of talking about how, what this means for those 24 million people. And also like just reminding people that the vast majority of people who are in the United States are not actually without authorization or on visa overstays. They're not actually, right, somehow like crossing the Southwest border in, you know, as I just, with all the news headlines in the last, you know, couple of months over the sort of the border control itself across the river. So,
yeah, that, I mean, and this also gets to the sort of the reality of immigration in the United States versus to some degree, the political narratives around it. That the reality of immigration, authorized and unauthorized, is much different than a lot of the political narratives that we are often hearing about. And your research is about, like, essentially where these happen, like where the immigrant in the United States encounters the government. And how the government then responds to the immigrant, authorized or unauthorized, in the United States. And
most of those touch points, I was going to say, right, are not CBP, right, or formerly, or ICE, or whatever iteration of INS earlier, right? A lot of that interaction is happening in the schoolroom, in a local business, applying for a license. You know, that kind of interaction is really much more sort of needs to be part of the narrative.
And so in a lot of what you're talking about, and you say you have these, the four categories of education, which we've talked a little bit about already in terms of the opportunity for K through 12, the question of some of the welfare and civil liberties. But two of the other areas that also make strange political bedfellows is the sort of labor market and employer sanctions. And these are two policy areas that, again, are sort of operating in a way that most of us don't necessarily on a daily basis think about. This is where immigration is happening. This is the touch point. Can you talk about those two particular, because they're part of the same sort of structure?
Right. So I look at sort of, so there's a movement in the 1970s to start passing employer sanctions. And it starts in California. And it's one of those policy areas that, right, if you look at today, I think would surprise many people, right? So many of the people who are pushing some of the early employer sanctions bills are sort of what you would think of as traditional anti-immigrant nativists. But you're also, right, strong union support, support from groups like the Urban League, right? So you've got this sort of across it's not it's kind of a bipartisan, well, it splits both parties, right? It's splitting the Democratic Party and it's splitting the Republican Party in the 1970s. And they're pushing more and more as a way to sort of to think about as a way of immigration enforcement, to really think about employer sanctions in the United States. And for the Republican Party, right, it puts them in an odd space because they have these traditional anti-immigrant nativists, right? But you have all these people in the Reagan administration, right, who think the last thing we need is more government regulation, right? We're the anti-government, get the government off the backs of American businesses, right? This is not something that we would support. This goes so antithetical to what we think about business and enterprise in the United States. And so you have this real rift in the Republican Party, right? And on the Democratic side, you have those who are sort of much more on the sort of thinking about sort of what rights are more broadly and a sort of more human rights-based sort of a sort of narrative versus some of the more restrictionist members of labor unions, and as I mentioned, some traditional African American interest groups. And so these two parties, sort of these four groups, sort of struggle to find their alliances and sort of where they think this can go. And they spend like almost the early envisions of this are early sort of iterations of this in 1972 in California, but it really starts being proposed in the federal government in the mid 1970s, like 76, 77, and you see the Carter administration wrestling with it, and you have this whole decade where basically these four groups are sort of wrestling with each other over what employer sanctions means, and is this a deal that we're going to do? And they end up getting it through the 1986 Immigration Reform and Control Act, known as IRCA. But by the time it gets through, it's nothing that anyone thought it would be, and it has been stripped of every enforcement mechanism, right? In some ways, it's like the Republicans have pushed so hard, and I think this is actually a turning point for the anti-immigrant movement, because they're like, we put so much faith in the federal government and this framework to get this through. We fought so hard from the mid-70s till 1986, and this is all we got, right? We got this like kind of on the books employer sanctions, there's no real mechanism tool, there's no real tracking, it's sort of gutted from within, and they're kind of like, and a lot of that gutting actually is, you know, done by the Republican Party and the Reagan administration, right? There's a big debate over having these identification cards, right? And that sort of strikes a very hard no in some of the libertarian elements of the Reagan White House, right? And so I think that leaves, by the end of the 1980s, you have these members sort of what I would call more traditional nativists within the Republican Party who have put so much faith saying, okay, we've got our guy in the White House. We're going to move forward on this. And after a decade, we got basically nothing. And we kind of give up, they sort of, I would argue, sort of give up on the federal government as the place to make change and really pivot to the state houses.
And to some degree, you see not quite the same thing in terms of the ideology, but on the left, you see the protection that labor wants to sort of have in terms of limiting how many people are looking for the jobs, as it were.
Yeah. They view it as a job protection sort of element. And what we see, and it's a very slow change, right? It's a change that begins in the 1970s. UFW is going to change their policies very slowly. Obviously, and it does not happen for groups like the AFL-CIO for a while, right? But it is slowly, that's sort of the beginning of the moment where I think, particularly among labor unions with large Latinx populations, right, they start to see the ways in which their fates are intertwined with the undocumented population, but it takes a while. And it's also not just a shift in terms of labor organizations. You see this in terms of, you know, groups like MALDEF, the Mexican American Legal Defense and Education Fund. They start out part of the 1970s, not really seeing the rights of undocumented individuals in the United States as part of their purview. But it really sort of, the ways in which immigration politics are shifting during the 1970s, they come to shift their position, right? And they end up being one of the lead attorneys on the Plyler case about education, because they sort of see the ways in which the winds are shifting and they shift their tactics, right? They make a very sort of very firm tack and sort of move the interest group alignment at that point too.
And so I wanted to take you from the 70s to the 90s, because the 90s is a place where also we see a shift in terms of the political economy that then also has ramifications for the immigration policies inside the United States. And so we're out of the Cold War, and we're in this sort of more of a freer market, freer globalizing market. But how does this particular time period, where you also have talked about the sort of shifts in the demographics, how does this particular time period then impact some of these internal domestic policies around immigration?
Right. So I think you see in particular, you know, California at this moment is going through an economic downturn, right? They're one of the states that is hit hardest by the recession of the early 1990s. And I think people always look for a scapegoat, right? And I think even though it has, you know, we all know, have looked at the sort of data, right, that immigrants really add more in terms to the economy than they take away, and they add more particularly to the social safety net, right? We have all this data that shows the ways in which immigrants pay into the system more than they withdraw. That's not the narrative you get in the early 1990s. And I think as sort of the ground beneath people's feet is shifting, and particularly sort of the anti-immigrant sort of nativist groups start to gain a foothold in parts of California, right? As people start to say, okay, the service economy is changing, the jobs, the narrative is the jobs are disappearing, the service economy is rising. Where's this social safety net, and why are these people having access to it at this moment where I might need it, right? And that sort of, even though the data may not be there, that's the narrative that you get during the 1990s, right? And that sort of shifts sort of how people, you know, people are doing less well than their parents were. That's sort of driving a lot of the narrative that's coming out of these anti-immigrant movements at this moment. And it combines with this whole national debate about the economics of the welfare state, right? And entitlement spending. Like, we have huge amounts of entitlement spending during the 1990s, and the anti-immigrant groups do a really good job of tying sort of the question about entitlement spending, or sort of using the national debate about entitlement spending as a way to sort of open up a conversation about immigrants' access to those benefits.
And so we have all of this that is sort of, as you note, 1965 was definitely a watershed in terms of changing policies inside the United States with regard to the national approach to immigration. But then you have these particular periods, the 1970s, the 1990s, the efforts, as you know, sort of as I watched them during the George W. Bush administration to try to get a sort of universal immigration reform package through that nobody supported. And then we get to 2016 with Donald Trump campaigning on building a wall that Mexico is going to pay for as the solution to immigration problems in the United States, be they real or imagined. And Greg Abbott currently is being sued by the federal government for some of what he's doing down on the Texas border. So how did we get here exactly?
Well, I think this is a big thing that I try and stress, which is I think a lot of people in the wake of the 2016 election sort of looked at it and like this was Trump was a sort of a deus ex machina, like that just sort of popped down and we didn't see him coming, you know, like it just sort of happened. But I think if you look in particular around immigration, you can see, right, that this is really a sort of 3 decades long shift that has happened, right? And we've seen immigration sort of percolating up at specific moments. We've seen the anti-immigrant movement try out different strategies. Right? They try the federal push in the 80s. They see it doesn't work. They go to the state houses, right? A lot of what we're seeing right now is sort of things didn't really, we'd never got a comprehensive deal under George W. Bush at the federal level. Let's try and move it, right? Sheriff Joe Arpaio very famously, like, you know, has this moment in 2010 where he starts to go back sort of, right? So we see a lot of this coming through these cycles, right? Where they've learned, sort of immigration activists on both sides have learned sort of what's worked and what's not working over these last 30 years. And they're sort of applying it at current day. And so I don't think you can look at the 2016 election as something that just sort of came. We've seen this rise in anti-immigrant sentiment. We've seen them move away. You know, I think what was surprising to me about 2016, but in the mid-1970s through the 80s, early 90s, the language of the anti-immigrant movement really moved away from sort of the overtly racist sentiment to these sort of coded languages about entitlement spending and the rights of taxpayers and immigrants taking sort of these jobs and sort of it moved. So to me, what was surprising about 2016 was the sort of the reversion back to some of the overt racism, but I wasn't surprised by that, by the use of sort of the the power of the anti-immigrant sentiment of 2016. I just sort of was interested in sort of the ways in which the language had actually sort of reverted back a little bit to some of the stuff that, you know, in the 1970s, 80s, 90s, right? Many people felt that in the wake of the civil rights movement, you just couldn't use that language anymore. So they felt the need to code it in sort of these dog whistling politics. Now in 2016, the dog whistling went out the window, right? And it just, we came back. But I think that trend that you see building from the 70s to today, and in terms of both the political language and sort of the ways in which immigration plays a key role in these campaigns, is clear. And then the ways in which really beginning in the 70s, but really sort of coming to fruition in the 90s, what we see today, right? We can't be surprised that these governors, right, are using sort of creeping in the sense that on federal authority, because they've been doing this in slow, directed ways, right, for almost two decades now.
So it's not, and it's not new.
In California, we see, right, immigrant activists abusing on both sides, right? We see those in certain states, right, who are trying to sort of marginalize the immigrant population, or we have immigrant sort of incorporation at a state level in states like California, New York, and others, right, that are really sort of with things like driver's license and access to in-state tuition, and those sort of, those are all, you know, both sides have learned sort of how to use the state, the little states.
The little states. The 50 plus one. and localities, obviously, as you know, you talk about Sheriff Joe Arpaio in 2010, and state of Wisconsin sent some folks down to work with him. So, you know, again, localities and states operating in a really kind of checkered way, checkered, not bad, but checkered in terms of like a checkerboard way, sort of around and inside the immigration processes.
And I actually don't think that's going to change anytime soon, in the sense that I think we don't have any real move on comprehensive that looks particularly viable to me right now. And I think, you know, this might be the path that we're sort of on for a little while, or not a little while, a long while, right? I think sort of learning the limits of when the, very much up to the whim of the judiciary. Like, at what point are they going to, you know, or because I don't think we're going to see I don't think we have a chance at comprehensive anytime soon. And so I think this sort of state by state system will continue for the foreseeable future.
Which means a lot of different kinds of lawsuits, federal and states, localities coming at each other. So there isn't going to be a solution anytime soon. Sarah, according to what you're telling me, as a political scientist, I know you're a historian, but you know, we sort of shop in the same stores. And so what are you working on now?
So I'm sort of interested in, more of this sort of immigration federalism, right? And then thinking, particularly looking at the ways in which sort of interactions between certain communities in, I'm interested in this question of immigration federalism in particular, and the area that I'm sort of interested in more now is looking at, there are certain what we now think of as new growth states, right? Particularly during the 2000s, which are new destination states, which up until this point, you know, haven't seen much. They're still not the five biggest immigration receiving states, right? Those are traditionally, but they see their immigrant populations double. And at the same time, a lot of them are becoming swing states. So you start to look at states like North Carolina, like Nevada, like Colorado, like Virginia, right, that are seeing these massive sort of changes in their immigrant population, and looking at sort of how those, what are considered new growth or new destination states in the late 90s, early 2000s through the mid 2000s, sort of really sort of changed the federal story.
And is there anything in particular that you're seeing that's drawing you to these particular ideas in new growth states?
I feel like we have a lot of a much deeper understanding of how the federal government sort of pushes policy down, right? And we think about like very famous political science works like Ira Katznelson, right? And like others, when we think about how, right, the federal government really can influence state and local. And I really want to think through in these states, right, how that goes up, right? And how we really think through, in particular, these sort of very contested states, the role that electoral politics plays in pushing that policy up.
I look forward to reading that book. Hopefully you will come talk to me about it when it's done, because this one was actually such a pleasure to read. It is a beautifully written book, Sarah. And I want to thank Sarah Coleman for joining me today on the New Books Network to talk about The Walls Within, The Politics of Immigration in Modern America. I assume one can purchase this at the Princeton University Press website, as well as wherever anybody else gets books these days.
Thank you so much for having me, Lily.
It was my pleasure. Thanks for talking to me today.